Okay, so I'm going to talk today about a slightly different topic than what we've heard in the last couple of days, and mainly that's about ion channel mutations and how those relate to the development of clinical syndromes. And I'm going to talk to you about how we've developed and utilized theoretical models to try to get a handle on genotype-phenotype relationships. In the last 8 or 10 years, a large number of clinical syndromes that had been previously characterized as idiopathic have actually been since shown to stem from defects, genetic mutations, and transmembrane-spanning ion channels. And this slide outlines just a small subset of those. I think this isn't working. Namely, mutations in the voltage-gated sodium channel. And today I'll just focus on the SCN5A gene, which encodes the cardiac isoform, mutations in which have been shown to give rise to the development of long QT syndrome, Brugada syndrome, and isolated cardiac conduction disorder, all syndromes that are known to increase the susceptibility to arrhythmia. But just for fun, it's sort of neat to think about the others, which are the skeletal isoform mutations, which can cause paralysis and myotonias. And very recently, mutations in the brain channel isoforms have been shown to underlie a number of different types of epilepsy, and just in the last few months, familial autism. So it's an important goal, and it's becoming more and more common that we can identify genetic lesions and try to causally relate those to clinical syndromes. But what's equally important and much more difficult is to really understand how a lesion can disrupt the behavior at the level of the cell, how that then disrupts tissue, and then how that manifests as a phenotype in the patient. And one method to do that, to try to understand those relationships, is by using... Sure. Well, you mean statistical in the relationship between the lesion and the phenotype?
This is a population-based.
Yeah, it's a population studies.
But it's very...
limited.
Definite.
Well, it's definite in as much as you can say this. Here's a huge family. Everybody carrying this particular lesion is more susceptible to the development of this syndrome. What makes it really complicated is that the phenotypic manifestations are totally heterogeneous. Lots of reasons for that. Gender plays a role, even febrile states, and other genes, polymorphisms, and other genes that affect different proteins. So that makes the problem much more complicated. And one way to study that and to look for causal, you know, related genes is through transgenic animals. And another method is the one that I'll talk to you about and the reason I'm here, which is by using computational modeling. So what we've tried to do is to really start at the level of a single gene, take a lesion, and understand how that lesion can alter the function of a single ion channel protein. Really thoroughly investigate the gating at the level of a single channel protein, then relate that to a population of channels, and then try to understand how that altered population of channels interacts in this really complex cellular environment. Then relate that to abnormal electrical activity and see if that's consistent with what's observed on the electrocardiogram, what's recorded on the body surface. So we've all seen this before, but just to reiterate, the top is a normal electrocardiogram, and you can see the spiky QRS and the T wave that follows. And on the bottom panel is a clearly abnormal example recorded from a patient during an episode of ventricular tachycardia, and clearly abnormal. So cardiac excitation reflects underlying cellular processes at the level of the single myocyte. Excitation stems from membrane depolarization of myocytes, which results from influx of sodium through voltage-gated sodium channels. That fast action potential upstroke is followed by a long plateau phase, which allows influx of calcium through the L-type calcium channel, calcium-induced calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, diffusion of calcium binding to contractile proteins on the sarcomeres, and coordinated contraction. That plateau phase is followed by the opening of time and voltage-dependent potassium currents, which bring the membrane potential back to rest. And each of those phases can be observed on the body surface as an average of the spatial and temporal gradients recorded during each phase. So the QRS complex reflects gradients and depolarization, as you all know, and you can imagine that a cardiac conduction disorder might manifest as the widening of that QRS complex. Dispersion of plateau potentials manifests on the electrocardiogram as an ST segment elevation, which is a hallmark of the Brugada syndrome. And long QT, as the name implies, results in an increase in the length of the interval between this QRX and the T wave, and that reflects gradients of ventricular repolarization and prolongation of repolarization. So I'll talk about a couple of syndromes, today, namely the Brugada syndrome and the long QT syndrome. In all the simulations that I'll talk about, we've used a modified version of the Luo-Rudy model, which is one of the bad models, one of the bad complicated models. But hopefully I can convince you that we've really worked hard to try to make it better and much more based in the physiology than maybe it has been in the past. And this is just an example of the model. It is a complicated model. It takes into account a number of transmembrane spanning ion channels, pumps, exchangers, accounts for flux of sodium, potassium, and calcium. Also contains an internal compartment, which corresponds to the sarcoplasmic reticulum from which calcium is triggered during calcium influx through the L-type calcium channel. That triggers a calcium transient during the action potential, and those are just a couple of representative action potentials, and some of the major currents that contribute during the action potential. The large sodium current, which drives the action potential upstroke, the calcium current and the major repolarizing currents, the slow and the fast, rapidly activating components of the delayed rectifier. And one thing to sort of note here is that the amplitude of this sodium current is orders of magnitude different than any of the other currents. So sort of the take-home message from that is that what's happening in the beginning is this huge influx, but what's happening during the plateau are really small ionic fluxes. And that means that that plateau is very delicately controlled. You have calcium influx, potassium efflux. Small things can alter the waveform during the action potential plateau. Oh, and the other thing that's neat about this is that we can really now look at currents flowing during the action potential, which is something that you can't really do experimentally. So ion channels are always studied experimentally away from the system where they function physiologically. So they're studied clone channels and isolated expression systems. We can apply voltage clamp, but we can't really get a good idea of how the channels interact with the environment. And modeling, this type of modeling lets us do that. So until very recently, all of the action potential models have utilized Hodgkin-Huxley formalism in formulation of currents. And you all know these are gating parameters, which represent inactivation and activation, in the case of the sodium channel here. But these parameters, these gating parameters, are completely independent of each other. And this presents a problem because although these models are incredibly useful for helping us to understand dynamics and interactions, they fall short of being able to reproduce experimental observations. A good example is activation and inactivation of the voltage-gated sodium channel is known to be a strongly coupled process. And that's a process that can't be represented within this framework. So we wanted to do something different, and so we developed a Markov model of the sodium channel. This isn't it, this is just a simplified model. And what's neat about a Markov model is that it's really based in the channel physiology. We try to develop the model based on known states, discrete states that channels move through in response to changes in membrane potential. So here's a really simple example where a channel can reside in a closed state in response to a depolarization, opens, and then inactivates. And you can clearly see that inactivation of this channel requires channel opening. So there's a coupling between those two processes, which is much more representative of what's observed experimentally. And there's a structural counterpart for each of those discrete states. And this is sort of like the new way of thinking about voltage sensing from Rod McKinnon's recent paper, where we used to think of these tubes moving through the membrane in response to changes in voltage. Now we think they're paddles, and that's represented here. This is actually adapted from one of his papers. So now you can think about, okay, well, maybe there's a mutation that affects the activation transition, which is determined by this alpha 1 transition rate, which is dependent on voltage. A mutation that affects activation will, because of the coupling between these two states, also affect channel inactivation. And that's a realistic way of thinking about it. This type of modeling allows us to introduce lesions that we know affect specific interactions between discrete states. And one thing I just want to point out is that for those of you that don't think very often about channels, when we talk about transitions from closed to open states, we talk about activation. Open to inactivation states is inactivation. And inactivation, recovery from inactivation, would be this beta 2 parameter. And deactivation would be channels moving from open to closed states. And those are transitions that I'll talk about, so I just want to outline those. So we can compute the probability of residency in each of these states over the course of changing voltage by solving a system of coupled ODEs. Simple coupling between them pretty much says, you know, a channel residing in the closed state, the probability of residency in the closed state is determined by how many channels are leaving this state, which is a function of this voltage-dependent parameter, and how many channels are moving from this state into this state, which is a function of this deactivation voltage-dependent parameter. And as you change voltage, you make those transitions more or less likely, but they also depend on the probability of residency in the neighboring states. And because the probabilities must add to unity, we can solve, given n states, we can solve n minus 1 of these equations. So today I just want to give an overview of the way that we've used this modeling, a couple of examples which I think illustrates the breadth of possibilities for using this. And the first example is the simplest example, and it's also was the first lesion to be found in the cardiac isoform of the voltage-gated sodium channel. And that was found by Paul Bennett and his group in 1995, and that's the delta KPQ mutation. And this mutation is a deletion of 3 amino acids in the linker between domains 3 and 4. So this is a topological map of the sodium channel where there are 4 distinct domains, each with 6 transmembrane spanning segments. There's clusters of positively charged residues in each of the 4th segments, and those are thought to act as the voltage sensor, and that's what Rod McKinnon has recently shown, that these move like paddles, not in the sodium channel, but in a similar voltage-gated channel. This lesion is in an intracellular linker that's known to play a major role in fast inactivation of the channel. So it's thought that this linker contains a motif called an IFM motif, which interacts with residues inside the channel pore and acts to occlude the pore following a depolarization. Channels open. This particle occludes the pore from the intracellular side and prevents further flux of ions. And that's illustrated here. So under normal circumstances, at rest potential, sodium channels are closed. That means they're available to open. In response to depolarization, they open, and you get an inward flux of sodium. The channels then inactivate rapidly as a result of the occlusion of the pore by this IFM motif. In the delta KPQ mutation, the story is different. And the mutation results in channels that fail to inactivate. It's a small population of channels that fail to inactivate, and the failure is transient. But you can sort of think about why that might be, and it's illustrated here schematically. At depolarized membrane potentials, where wild-type channels are normally inactivated, these delta KPQ mutant channels allow for the passage of sodium ions at inappropriate times. And because this mutation results in hyperactivity of the channel, we refer to that type of mutation as a gain of function. Okay? And I think a really neat way to think about why this might be is to really think about the structure of the channel. And this is actually a homology model that was done by Ansui Yang at Columbia, who lives next door to me. And it's largely based on the NMR solution structure that was done by Bill Catterall's group, although they only solved about this portion, and the rest of it is modeled based on structural homology. The red residues are the IFM motif, which I told you interact with residues inside the channel pore, and that's what causes that occlusion. The delta KPQ residues are shown in green, and in this mutation, those residues are deleted. So you can sort of think about how that might shorten this peptide and prevent appropriate interaction with those residues inside the channel pore. So really trying to base it all in the physiology and really think not only about how it affects cellular behavior, but how it really works. So what we've done is to develop a model that can, for the most part, reproduce what's been observed experimentally. And the easiest way to really think about and examine sodium channel behavior is to look at single channels, gating of single channels. So these are four consecutive traces of single channels where, in response to a depolarization, channels open, and that's indicated by that downward deflection. Channels open, rapidly inactivate, and you don't see any further activation of the channel throughout the length of that depolarization. And that's true four consecutive times and probably 100 consecutive times. Once in a while, you'll see something slightly different, but for the most part, this is what it looks like. And we've been able to simulate that behavior, and I'll show you exactly how in a minute. And you can see there's good agreement between the simulation and the experiment. In the case of the mutant channels, the single channel gating looks different. And there's two discrete forms of gating, both of which look different than the wild type, which have alterations. And the first is in these top three traces, where channels open, like wild type channels, and inactivate. But the inactivation state is destabilized. And so that permits these late openings, which are absent in the wild type. The other mode of gating is what we refer to as a burst mode, a burst gating, where channels completely fail to inactivate. So this type of bouncing back and forth between closed states and open states is referred to as bursting. There's no inactivation at all. And we've also been able to simulate that behavior. And again, I'll show you how in a minute. If you look at the combination of these two types of abnormal gating in the whole cell, so now it's a full cell voltage clamp, you can clearly see that there's a late component of current, this is during depolarization, that's absent in the wild type. So channels open, rapidly inactivate, there's nothing going on here. They require repolarization of the membrane to recover from that inactivation. The delta KPQ case, there's a fraction of channels that keep working, hyperactive, gain of function. What's important, though, to realize is that this fraction is really small. So this is about 0.5% of the peak current. But remember, I showed you that that peak current that drives the action potential upstroke is two orders of magnitude larger than any of the currents that are flowing during the plateau. Nonetheless, we thought, this is really small. Is it possible that that small current amplitude flowing during the plateau potentials is sufficient to disrupt cellular behavior? So here's the model which we developed to reproduce this behavior. And it looks more complicated than that linear three-state model, but it's really not. It's really the same principles that apply. And each of these discrete states are based on something that we know about the channel, transitions that it makes, true structural transitions. So channels move through closed states. Each of these closed states can be thought to correspond to a channel that's closed because not all of the voltage sensors have yet moved. So maybe C3 corresponds to no voltage sensor movement or one voltage sensor movement, and we've lumped those two together because for accuracy it doesn't really matter. Here, two of the voltage sensors have moved. Here, three of them have moved. And then when the fourth voltage sensor moves, the channel opens. Then we get this rapid inactivation, which results from occlusion of the pore by that IFM motif. And then we get these slower inactivation states. And we know that these slower inactivation states exist because we can look at the time course of recovery. Depending on how long you depolarize the cell, if you depolarize for a short time, channels are here and they recover fast. If you depolarize for a longer time, they get stuck here, and an even longer time results in them being stuck here. So there's structural counterparts that we can see experimentally. And then closed inactivation states, you can think of these as here, one or no voltage sensors have moved, but the channel pore has been occluded by that IFM motif. Here, two have moved, but the channel's occluded. Three have moved, the channel's occluded. Okay, so there's a structural counterpart. And that's important because I think that's really what makes this different, how these models deviate from the traditional sort of Hodgkin-Huxley way of thinking about gating parameters.
This is one illustration. I see this in activation and close.
Yes.
IF?
Fast inactivation.
What is it, IM?
Intermediate inactivation.
The structures are not crystallized.
It's not crystallized yet.
When you talk about structure, can you elaborate?
Sure. So for example, we know about these different states through the measurement of gating currents. So people look not ionic currents, but gating currents, which represents movement of the voltage sensors. And we think of that one movement as a state that's discrete and different from no voltage sensor movement.
Voltage movement, so what kind of experiment is that? It's not a patch clamp.
It is a patch clamp with a really, really tight seal, not looking for ionic current. So just applying a capacitive current and looking for change in the voltage field.
Nice.
Okay.
And that's what they do. You have these kind of four paddles.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can you measure transition rates from those experiments?
Right. So this is what we know. We can certainly measure this one, right? Because this is the activation. But we know that movement of these voltage sensors, at least we think, is cooperative. They happen, one goes, the next goes, the next goes, the next goes. So each of those stages is very similar, except maybe shifted by a millivolt or two in the voltage domain. Does that make sense? Okay.
Have you looked at this from the point of view of very limited edge? They are actually fractal and they're not, you just think states don't in fact exist. I had understood that at least for a lot of channels, he actually gets a much better agreement with a much simpler model.
Right. I think we do know these states exist, and if you look at Rod McKinnon's recent work, he actually shows those states in the crystal. So I would argue that this is a more accurate representation from a structural, from a physiological perspective. True. Sure. Yeah. That's a good question. Well, I can tell you this, that what we found in the lab is that pKa phosphorylation doesn't do much to the macroscopic current. It does have effects on late current, which has also been shown in neuronal channels. pKc phosphorylation is a little more complicated. And this doesn't take into account any of that phosphorylation. At some point, it may. It may even take into account calmodulin binding.
These slow time-course transitions, relatively slow time, are not phosphorylation.
Right, not at this time. Not at this time. So then the mutant channel model. It's really just like the wild-type channel model. The top nine states are exactly the same as what I just showed you, except that there's slight destabilization, so slightly faster recovery from inactivation from these intermediate and fast inactivation states, which generates this type of behavior. And then bursting, which is shown in red, is exactly the same as above too, but it lacks this entire row of inactivation states. So here, these channels just bounce back and forth between closed and open states and generates this bursting behavior, which really corresponds to what's been observed experimentally. Transitions into this burst mode are probabilities. So it's just a small fraction of channels that exist in this mode, and they can move back and forth. Sometimes they're normal, sometimes they're not normal, and that's also consistent with experimental observations, and it's also relatively voltage independent. So we take these abnormal gating behaviors, and we really want to see what sort of the goal is how do those affect cellular behavior? So we pluck out this Hodgkin-Huxley sodium current that existed in the Luo-Rudy model, and we replace it with the Markov model, the normal and the abnormal model, and we look at the effect on cellular behavior. And what we found was really interesting.
What is the probability to get you this single cell behavior?
Well, so the model, the original model, is based on the single channel data and also macroscopic, a lot of macroscopic data that I didn't show you.
The frequency bursting and all that, you got that from a testing probability.
Right, exactly. And the way we did that, actually, the way we initially did that was to look at the amplitude of current at the end of a macroscopic current pulse, and from that to compute how many channels needed to be in that burst mode of gating. What we've actually done since then is taken experimental data, long time series data, and actually derived the rates into and out of that burst mode. And they were actually really close to what we'd come up with the first time, the same order of magnitude, which is really quite small. So that was a more recent paper last fall, but I won't talk about that today. So when we look in the action potential, on the left is a wild-type action potential and the corresponding sodium current. All of these sodium currents are shown at high gain, so you're not seeing the peak, it's just the late current. And you can see sodium channels activate, rapidly inactivate, normal action potential. And this is at a relatively fast cycle length. When we put in these mutant channels, you can clearly see prolongation of the action potential. And as we slow the pacing cycle length, we start to see the development of these arrhythmogenic early after depolarizations. And that is consistent with what's observed clinically, where people that carry this particular mutation have bradycardia-dependent arrhythmias. Okay?
How many channels do you actually, I mean, the number matters here, right? And you use these macroscopic models.
Right.
Do you count them all? I mean, how many channels?
No, so there's one way is to do a whole bunch of stochastic simulations and sum them. I'm not doing that. I'm computing these as populations now. How do we figure out what the membrane conductance is through that channel? Well, we know that the amplitude of the sodium current is almost directly related to the velocity of the action potential upstroke. So we know it should be about 300 volts per second. We've also put these models in a fiber and looked at conduction velocity, which should be about 44 centimeters per second. And the appropriate amplitude of the sodium current determines conduction velocity.
You put it into a relatively uniformly over your cell
wall? Yes, okay. Yes. But that's really an interesting point. And I think one of the things that we sort of were talked a little bit about yesterday is the distribution of those channels, how they relate to propagation. And that's certainly something we're thinking about now. And also other sodium channel isoforms, which have completely different recovery kinetics, which will totally affect conduction. So, yeah. Oh, and just to point out that then, you know, somebody did an action potential clamp of this mutant current, and the morphology of the current looks very similar to what we compute. Okay, so that's sort of the simple example. And the next example is more complicated. And because it's more complicated, it's more interesting. Or maybe it's more interesting. Well, anyway. So the next mutation is an insertion of an aspartic acid in the C-terminus of the sodium channel at position 1795, which seems to be somewhat of a hot spot. There are other mutations that affect that same residue. What's fascinating about this mutation is that it underlies a double phenotype. So patients that carry this mutation have long QT syndrome when the heart rate is slow, and they have Brugada syndrome when the heart rate is fast. So they display ST segment elevation at fast heart rates and long QT syndrome, prolongation of the QT interval at slow rates. What we didn't understand is how this could happen in the same patient, because long QT, as I told you, is gain of function. The Brugada syndrome is associated with a loss of sodium channel function. So it's paradoxical that these two things could coexist. And we wondered if maybe we could examine the kinetics and think about why that might be the case. So again, normal sinus rhythm, just to remind you, prolongation of the QT interval, ST segment elevation, you can clearly see that elevation of the ST segment, reflecting dispersion of plateau potentials. When we look at the kinetics of this channel, the major finding is that the channel affects recovery from inactivation. So I won't go into this too much, but suffice to say that this rightward shift of channel recovery, this reflects how long the channel takes to recover following a depolarization. The mutant channels exhibit a rightward shift that says that they take longer to recover than the wild-type channels. Channels that take longer to recover are less available, So you see a corresponding leftward shift of the channel availability curve and no change in the activation. What's interesting is that when we put this same shift, it's about a twofold increase, or rather reduction, in the rate of recovery from inactivation in the model, we see exactly the same shift in channel availability. So it's just a one parameter change, which has been measured experimentally. The other thing, though, about these channels is that they burst, like KPQ channels, like what I showed you before. And I haven't shown that here. So there's a late component of current that's present in these channels. Slow recovery from inactivation and late current. Slow recovery from inactivation, as you might suspect, can result in the reduction of current at fast heart rates. If channels take longer to recover and we pace them rapidly, the diastolic interval is short, we get a loss of current on each successive beat. And that's shown here. In the experiment, channels are depolarized 20 times, but allowed 2 seconds in between to recover. You don't see any loss of current. With each beat, the current's just as large as it was the time before. And that's because there's a sufficient period of recovery in between each depolarization. When you pace the channels fast, you start to lose current with every beat. And you see that in the wild type case, and that's been known for some time. But in the mutant case, it's more pronounced. And that's because channels recover more slowly from inactivation. So you get more loss of current on each beat. And we reproduce that principle in the simulations. Okay, so the myocardial wall is comprised of at least three distinct cell types. Epicardial cells, which are characterized by these larger repolarizing currents, mainly IKS and ITO, and as a result have shorter action potential durations. Mid-myocardial cells, on the other hand, and this is just schematic, these could be islands of cells, I don't know how they're really, have smaller repolarizing currents and longer action potential durations. Do we know, David, how they're distributed now?
A lot more complicated than that.
Okay, yeah, so much longer action potential durations. So we hypothesized that perhaps the mutation interacts differentially with these different cell types, and that might underlie the propensity for patients to develop ST segment elevation at fast rates and long QT syndrome at slow rates. So we tested this by developing models of epicardial and mid-myocardial cell types based on experimental observations of changes in current density, and we put the wild type in the 1795 INSD mutant model into the cell. And here's what we found. That at fast rates, in one cell type, in epicardial cell types, which have this large repolarizing current, large ITO, large IKS, you get a reduction in sodium current at fast rates with each successive beat. That smaller sodium current is overwhelmed by these large potassium currents, causes this premature repolarization. In this beat, this cove dome morphology, you get a premature repolarization. Oh, but the calcium current says, I can activate now. And the calcium current results in this secondary hump. Then that's followed by a short diastolic interval. It's like alternance. The next beat, overwhelming. Even more loss of sodium current because of the short diastolic interval, completely overwhelmed, and loss of the action potential plateau. In both and it doesn't happen in the M cell, okay, which is the guy next door. In both cases, there's dispersion of plateau potentials. Well, that's what we think underlies ST segment elevation. So it explains, at least it provides a suggestion for the mechanism at fast rates why these patients develop ST segment elevation. At slow rates, the story is completely different. Slow rates, you have sufficient recovery of sodium current on every beat. So it's large. It never gets overwhelmed by those large repolarizing currents. But those bursting channels result in action potential prolongation, as I showed you with the KPQ. So we'd expect from the simulation at slow rates, long QT syndrome, at fast rates, ST segment elevation, stemming from interaction of this mutation with the heterogeneous myocardium. Alan?
If you break that, but
ST segment elevation, I mean, classically, Bill, if somebody comes in to you with ST segment elevation, you say, lie down, because you're having a heart attack and we're taking you to the
chest. Ah, okay, I'm sorry. What I didn't say, it's very select ST segment elevation. In one or two leads, corresponding to the area just above the right ventricular outflow tract, which is close to the body surface, just in those leads. Now, Sylvia Priori has actually shown that in these patients, if you give flecainide, if you give a sodium channel blocker, you can bring out ST segment elevation other places too. Right, only in the right ventricular outflow tract, and that's important, and I didn't say that. And also, that's exactly where Charlie Anzelovich has shown larger repolarizing potassium currents. Larger ITO, higher ITO density than anywhere else in the heart. So consistent with that idea.
Well, you know, I think Alan's point is pretty well taken, though, that regardless of the lead distribution, if somebody came in with ST elevation, in the intracardiac lead, V1 and V2, the first 10 choices would be acute intramyocardial infarction, and the 11th choice would be the
right, okay. Okay. Okay, in the absence of structural heart disease.
Right.
Yeah, and just to sort of follow on that point, I think what's fascinating about looking at these types of mutations is it really provides us an opportunity to look at electrical abnormalities in the absence of structural abnormalities. So it really reduces the system for us and lets us understand more carefully how electrical abnormalities by themselves can underlie arrhythmia. Okay. Okay, so the next one is again different. And this was a really neat, it's not even a mutation, this is a polymorphism, which means that it's a change, an amino acid change, that occurs in a much larger population. And this particular polymorphism is the Y1102. And that was found by Mark Keating and Igor Splotsky at Harvard to occur in about 13% of the African American population, completely absent in the Caucasian and Asian populations. And what they found was that patients that carry this Y allele have an increased susceptibility to drug-induced arrhythmia. We made this mutation and we looked at it in isolated cell expression systems, and we didn't see much. So when we compare the S currents to the Y currents, they really look quite similar. And initial investigation, we really didn't think that this lesion could be the cause of any increased susceptibility to arrhythmia. So we looked at it a little bit more closely. And again, there are changes in gating, but they're subtle. Experimentally, we see about a 5 millivolt shift in the left direction in the experiment, and about a 20% increase in the peak current. So we simulated that 5 millivolt shift, which predicted a 20% increase in the peak current, which is sort of nice. Again, the changes are subtle. What would we expect to see as a result of this? An increase in the velocity of the action potential upstroke. That's about it. We did see a slight increase in the late current. So these channels burst a little bit, but not so much, not nearly as much as KPQ or the mutation that I just showed you. But when we put it into the model anyway to see what would happen, and it was really interesting. In the absence of any intervention, the action potentials look almost exactly the same. But then we started to titrate in a potassium channel blocker. And at a 25% block of IKR, we don't see any phenotype. 50%, we start to see the development of these arrhythmogenic early after depolarizations in the Y allele, not in the S allele. And as we titrate in more, we see it in both. What's interesting about this one is that the mechanism is different than all the others that I've showed you. It's related to this faster action potential upstroke, which results in a slightly higher peak potential. That causes more potassium current at the very beginning, but that increases the driving force for the calcium current. It's complicated. That calcium current prolongs the action potential plateau a little bit and allows for this reactivation and development of these EADs. Subtle, but we see something that's consistent with what's observed in the patient.
These are simulations.
These are simulations, right. Yeah, and I think like this study in particular is really a good example of how if we just looked at the data, we really couldn't have drawn any conclusion. We couldn't have guessed that this lesion might actually underlie increased susceptibility. Okay, and the last one that I'll talk about is neat, and it's something we've done recently, and it's neat because it's not like the others. Okay? So this is another C-terminal mutation in the sodium channel, and data from our lab now is really starting to implicate the C-terminus as a major player in channel inactivation. We've shown some direct interactions between that 3-4 linker that I talked about before that occludes the channel pore and the C-terminus. And what's neat about this is a long QT mutation, but there's no gain of function. There's no obvious gain of function. In fact, it looks pretty much just like the wild type. And for a long time, we sort of looked at this mutation. We thought, it can't be it. There must be a modifier gene or another mutation. But more detailed examination of the kinetics, we see a change in channel recovery from inactivation. So I told you before, those 1795 INSD channels, mutant channels, recover more slowly. These channels recover more rapidly. So we see an increase in channel availability. But still, that doesn't mean much because we're measuring these, we're taking these measurements under steady state conditions. How could that really translate into a gain of sodium channel function? So we thought we'd ask the question, can we sort of play around with the simulation, subject the simulated cell to a bunch of different types of protocols and see if we can bring out some sort of behavior that would help to explain what's going on, and then can we test that experimentally? So in thinking about it, when we look at ion channels in expression systems, we sort of always do the same thing. We measure the channels under conditions of voltage clamp, which tells us things about steady state properties of the channels. But channels aren't at steady state ever during the action potential. And so what's the transition that we're missing? What's the one that we're never capturing, that we're never thinking about? And it's this transition. Channels open and then rapidly inactivate. But how do we look at what happens following that inactivation at membrane potentials that are plateau potentials, that are repolarization potentials? We never look at those. When we look at recovery from inactivation, we bring the cell back to rest. We make it really negative. But what if there's a voltage dependence to this recovery of inactivation and we're just missing it because we're always measuring it at the same voltage? And maybe there's something different going on in this mutant that's different from the wild type. So we wanted to look at transitions that occur subsequent to open state inactivation and to really think about how those might affect the action potential during the plateau. So we developed this negative ramp protocol. We depolarize the cell for 100 milliseconds. That forces all these channels into these slower inactivation states. So it's stable inactivation. Really requires repolarization for rapid recovery from that inactivation. And then we subjected them to a long, slow repolarizing ramp. In the wild type case, we sort of see what we would expect to see, which is this transient current as channels recover from inactivation and then reactivate. It's a really small population of channels. In the mutant, it's a lot bigger. It's about twice as large. And what's notable is that the late current, it's really small, measured at the end of each depolarization, is exactly the same. But what happens, that transition out of that inactivation state is different in the mutant. So it's like a dynamic, a non-equilibrium gating of the sodium channels that we've looked at. And then we did the same protocol experimentally, and it was weird. I mean, it was almost exactly the same change in amplitude that was predicted by the simulation. It's summarized here. About twice as large, that ramp current during the repolarization. So we put it in the action potential, and again, we see the same thing. And it's actually funny, if you look at the amplitude of the current during the repolarization phase of the action potential, something about repolarization of the action potential is actually perfectly suited to bring out this altered recovery from open state and activation. And we see the development of these rhythmogenic early after depolarizations. What's different too about this mutation is that its location is in the binding pocket for local anesthetics. So if you can imagine treating a patient here with a sodium channel blocker, you're going to have a problem because the blocker won't bind. You've disrupted the binding site of the channel blocker. So another thing to think about when thinking about mutations. And finally, that's it. And finally, I just want to say, just want to acknowledge my colleagues, Robert Cass at Columbia, Yoram, Rudy from CASE. Michihiro Tatsuyama did most of the experimental studies that I showed you today that we used to develop the simulations. And Igor Splosky and Mark Keating, with whom we collaborated on the polymorphism study. Thank you.
More about those experiments, whether it is the sealed or touch clamp.
The gating experiments?
Where you just look at capacity current, the voltage response, and how from that you can guess those states.
Okay. So maybe we could talk about it a little later, having not actually done those experiments myself. But it's actually...
It's not a little detail, but I mean, see, for me, I like crypto because I have worked in it, to understand how does one construct this model, you know, where does one make a guess, or what can you really conclude from experiment.
Right.
Because, you know, from a modeling standpoint, if you tell me that you don't fully close, let's say the first example, you still have some open sodium channel, it was a small fraction, 0.5%. And I know that the sodium current is 2 orders of magnitude larger, 2 orders of magnitude times 0.5%. I know that the product is comparable to the other current.
Exactly.
So that's fine. I don't need a Markov model to understand that then I'm going to get, you know, this lower course of repolarization. I can get DADs and all kinds of problems after that.
Right.
So, you know, what is it that the Markov model is going to really bring as a new insight, let's say that first example, beyond just that statement? And, you know, how much is it really, you know, how reliable it is, you know, from those experimental data and constructing those states?
Right. Well, I mean, I guess I can say that, like, in terms of, I'm not really sure how to answer your question. I can say that in terms of understanding gating of channels, how different discrete states interact with each other, how changing a parameter over here affects a parameter over here, is something that hasn't really been well thought out. And I think demonstrating it with the models and then showing experimentally that you can reproduce that same behavior, changing this one parameter, right, and then seeing the effect over here, it tells you something about the coupling between states and the model. Does that make sense? So there's a feedback between the model and the experiment. The other thing is this, okay, so gating current measurements, I mean, it's pretty much, you have a membrane, you apply a charge on the membrane, a small charge, a capacitive current, that's not sufficient to depolarize and activate an ionic current, but what you can still measure is these small changes in potential that result from voltage sensors moving in the membrane. But now, more's been done than that, okay? And this is what Rod McKinnon's group has shown. If you have these channels in the membrane and you have this voltage sensor, you can apply a fluorescent antibody that interacts on the outside, and when it interacts with residues that you've mutated here, causes a fluorescence. And we know those are the positively charged residues. Yeah, and then you can do it also from the inside, which demonstrates movement of that paddle across the membrane. So you take all of those pieces and you put them together, and that suggests that, you know, these things are moving. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
In a simple question, what kind of cells are you using to study sodium channels? You're not using cardiac cells.
We have used some cardiac cells. We have a delta KPQ mouse, which we've, you know, patch clamped a bit. For the most part, the experiments are done in HEK cells, co-expressed with the beta subunit.
Exactly.
So
the system contains only sodium channels.
nothing else.
Exactly, and you do TTX subtraction to be sure that you're only measuring the TTX sensitive sodium current.
This is not a question, this is a point I want to make on the behalf of the microbiologist. Can you go back to the early slide from your major paper where you show the Lou Rudy picture and then your markup?
Yeah.
Because there's the basic thing that Colleen is doing is really important. I think it has to be seen from a certain nonlinear dynamics point of view. So up there is the model of one of these things.
The formula.
Yeah. This is this.
Right.
So her point, and read the introduction to their Nature paper, because they say very clearly that people tend to look at the upper thing in isolation, and that's the empirical methodology. You take that, you clone that channel, you express it in a frog oocyte, and then you record that channel's activity. But down there in the cell, and I'm just basically quoting a little bit, down there in the cell, that thing is voltage coupled to every one of those other things. And it's voltage coupled to every one of those other things in a very nonlinear way. So the results that you get from looking at it in isolation may have nothing to do with the results that she correctly sees when she puts that thing integrated into the big cell model. Because from the point of view of that upper object, that lower object is the size of this campus.
Okay, maybe it's time for one more question. Two more questions.
A wild type of the decay co-mutation. So the wild type is actually, in the data show, is inactive much slower than the mutant.
Yeah, so that's actually stuff that I didn't show. There are also changes in deactivation that result from the mutation, probably an allosteric effect. We're not exactly sure why, and also changes in open times, which you would expect. So, yeah, which is voltage dependent, which is how we know it's a deactivation alteration.
Do you believe that the recovery is through from the
right, so I think in normal circumstances, it's directly to closed states.
So they always told me that inactivation goes to closed,
right.
And closed goes to open.
Right, but it's not exactly true. Because, and what I showed in that mutation is that those channels recover more rapidly if they're at a voltage where activation is the favorable transition, they're going to reactivate, right? But when you look at recovery from inactivation at a really negative membrane potential, which is what we do, that favors a deactivation transition. So you don't see that. Does that make sense?
Okay, last question.
What's the characteristic length scale?
I'm sorry.
An equation is quite easy. You're sticking all these channels in there and you make a model. That's a characteristic length scale in there.
Line scale.
Length.
Oh, length scale. What do you mean?
Well, if you take a cable equation, typically you're pushing hard to it's a centimeter. But they're coupled, right? If they're all coupled together, as you said, then they must be a length. Right?
No, this is a giant ODE.
Oh, exactly. They're all tightly coupled.
Right. Oh, yeah. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. There's no okay. Spatial.
All right, next
great.
Speaker is
Alex. Thanks. Oh.